Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go home?
Hey, good morning and welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm Kate.
And I'm Bruce.
And this is Jake.
And there's Roberta coming.
I'm Roberta.
Hey, morning, everyone. We've got a busy program this morning, so first up is Bruce.
Well, recently I spoke with one of the owners of one of Portland's only, maybe the only, pickle packing operations. It's small, but it's very good. The man's name is Dave Barber, and here's our interview. Why do human beings pickle food? How did that happen?
For preservation, initially. Somewhere along the line, somebody found that leaving food and salt together made the food not go bad. You know, acid, salt, all preserve it. And there's different, you know, also smoke preserves food, different things, obviously. When, you know, especially with my migratory people, trying to preserve a really short harvest, especially curing meat or preserving meat, salting meat, you're not going to be able to find a lot of food in certain parts of, you know, certain areas. And, you know, once people started sailing to other places and taking these long trips, I mean, it required that they had preserved food. And, the techniques and everything evolved as well. I mean, initially it was just, you know, salt and fish or salt and meat. And after a while, you need a little bit more than just salt. You know, we give seasonings and, you know, obviously different parts of the world evolve different styles and using different things for acidification. You know, and, I mean, in India alone, they use they have three or four different kinds of acidulating ingredients. Lemon, tamarind, vinegar. There's a bunch of different things. And also through fermentation, wine making and beer making, you end up with vinegar a lot. And it was used for preserving.
When pickling began, probably drying and smoking would be the only other preservation methods at that time.
Right. I mean, they say that smoking, you know, just evolved from a half-cooked, you know, something sitting by the fire for a really long time, and they found that it didn't rot or didn't go bad as fast.
How did you get interested in pickling? How did that come about? And when you say we, I know it's the whole family.
I've always made pickles. I've been cooking for 35 years, and initially, I was like in a restaurant where they do one little pickle thing or something, and it was kind of a side deal. As I started working more places and learning more about food, the traditional, you know, that kind of artisanal stuff always appealed to me. Curing, smoking, you know, charcuterie, all that kind of stuff. And so I just started learning more about it and trying a lot of different stuff and seeing what worked and seeing what didn't and talking, you know, the usual thing you do when you learn how to do something. I've been using pretty much the same recipe for the last 15 or so years for the cucumber pickles. And we have them as ingredients in a bunch of different things in the restaurant. And, you know, I always keep adding to it and adding to it and adding to it to where we have maybe 20 different things that we pickle here. A lot of them are seasonal. So, like, right now we're in the, you know, we're at the beginning of spring and we haven't really seen a lot of new stuff coming. So a lot of what we have is just what we've been storing since September, since the last harvest. For cucumbers for the restaurant, it's one point during the winter where you can, like, maybe squeak out a couple cases out of Mexico or, you know, you're not getting local stuff during the winter. But we did make a couple batches during the winter. Of course, like carrots and beets, stuff like that we have available to make new stuff of. But again, since it's pickled and it's, you know, it's in a controlled percentage of acidity, it's not going anywhere, you know. And sometimes a lot of things will get overblind or over cured, but you can adjust that by testing the pH and adjusting it. A lot of vegetables during the cycle of curing, the acidity rises, and you want to keep it at a certain percentage or else it just becomes kind of tanned.
How much difference does it make to have something that still fresh, but it may have been picked a week or 10 days ago? Does that make a difference in the outcome?
Yeah, a lot. When you're pickling something as opposed to, like, marinating it, you are using the live cells to do your work. And obviously more recently they've been picked, the more live, the more active they are. Of course, you get cucumber and you put it in a refrigerator and it'll still be fresh for a couple of days. I mean, as far as being an alive piece of vegetable, but you know, it starts getting wrinkly or whatever. That's when the cells are starting to break down, and you need the active osmosis of the cell to be able to do your brining for you, where you put the vegetable into the acid or salt solution, and the cells osmose and trade off the salt or the vinegar for the liquid in the cells. So you're counting on that live cell to do that for you. So the longer that it's been in the field, the longer it's been since it was picked, the less activity it has, and the longer it will take for it to brine. We found, you work buying stuff from farmers, that stuff that was picked that day, it pickles really fast. Most of the obviously the cucumbers and the fermented stuff take a certain amount of time to do their magic. Other things like green beans or more thin-walled vegetables or thin pieces go a lot quicker. Some things you need to get almost, you know, cooked a little bit, like the carrots, because they're really, really hard. Just to pickle them takes a really long time.
Okay, well, let's talk about the process. Obviously, acquiring fresh raw materials and, in some cases, cutting pieces small enough that the salt and the brine can infiltrate. Then what do you do? And I know it varies from one food to another.
Yeah, well, let's start with the stuff that we do that's lacto-fermented. For example, here we have this is our Carolina kimchi and our red sauerkraut. Traditionally, kimchi is cabbage, garlic, salt, chilies. It's a Korean side thing, traditional, and it's eaten with almost everything in Korea. And there's a lot of different versions of it. They use a lot of different kinds of cabbage, a lot of different flavors. And our version of it is made with collard greens, garlic, and chilies and salt. And collard greens are one of the toughest cold crops. You can sit there and cook them, you know, saute them in a pan or whatever, and they're still as hard as when, you know, when we boil them here to use as a side dish, we cook them for like 3 hours. We just boil them for 3 hours in salt, garlic, and vinegar. And I get traditionally in the South, they also use like ham hocks or use pork in it. And our version is vegetarian because we use it with a bunch of different things. And we can always add stuff to it. But again, the kimchi that we do is collard greens, which have been sliced real thin, and then tossed with slivered garlic and crushed chilies. And then we toss it with salt and a little bit of black pepper and a little other seasonings. And then it gets packed into a food-grade barrel, and we put a weight on it, which some traditionally you use a muslin cloth with a ceramic weight, and you are keeping the ingredients weighted. And as they macerate, as the liquid's drawn out of them, the weight keeps the vegetable always submerged in the liquid. And so as that liquid comes out, it starts to ferment because of the sugars and everything that's in the vegetable. And then after it ferments, it turns into vinegar. And that takes a certain amount of time. There's a certain... usually takes about a week till it starts turning. We have the barrel. We keep it up on top of the walk-in here when we're making it. And there's a certain part where it starts expelling methane. And so we have a fan right over it to get it out of it because it's not something that you want to have. Yeah, you don't want to have in the kitchen. So it goes through that process, and it ferments, and then it starts turning vinegary. And in the case of the kimchi, since it's a really tough vegetable to begin with, the collard greens, we keep it in the liquid for about 2 months, which is a long time for doing that. Typically, pickles, you know, tops 2 weeks before you check the acidity and put them in the refrigerator. The sauerkraut takes about 10 days. Doing the cabbage lacto-fermented, it's just red cabbage, black pepper, fennel, and salt. And we toss it, do the same thing, weight it down. It goes through the same process. But it goes a lot quicker. Because cabbage, you can eat raw. It's not tough. It's not, you know, it's very appealing.
Collard greens in the kimchi are tender enough, but it must be after, as you say, hours of cooking. It's a good flavor. It's not traditional. I think a Korean would probably come in here and say, what did they do to my kimchi? But it's enjoyable, definitely. It's a thin leaf chopped up into pieces that are kind of long and narrow, no more than a quarter inch wide, even eighth inch wide. And then the red cabbage, which has fewer ingredients, is in slivers. And that cabbage wouldn't take as long to soften up as the collards would.
The cabbage, basically, you just slice it, you know, again, it's like an eighth of an inch thick, wide, and it breaks down pretty quickly. This is a fairly new batch, so it's not as vinegary as it's going to be. It's still a little, still salty.
It is.
And the kimchi is salty, but it just keeps getting better.
You talked about how long it takes minimum for it to be pickled, but the process does continue for a while. How long will pickled foods stay edible?
Barring, you know, something going wrong with your, you know, if you have them in a refrigerator, if it's a refrigerator pickle, you're kind of relying on your refrigeration, you have a little bit less acidity. With stuff that has, like sweet pickles, like bread and butter pickles, or carrots, butternut squash, a couple that we do that have sugar in them, they will get yeasty. And almost all pickling cookbooks, they sell you, if you're storing stuff that's, you know, starts getting that yeasty thing on it, you can skim it off because it kind of goes to the top and dies. But you do want to keep it, you do want to not have it go off on you. You know, a lot of times you'll have something, you know, the acidity will be off or something like that, and you can lose product. But I check it. I check the pH on all the, you know, on each batch as it goes along, and to make sure that it stabilizes. One batch from each season I keep to see how long it's going to last. And we have a barrel of peppers that we've had for 2 years. And I have some chow chow that's still in the, you know, that I'm still storing, and a couple things. So it's like I've been experimenting with that end of it too. Most of the stuff that we do is selling at the farmer's market. We're dealing with a kind of what we call a fresh product, where we're doing it not so much to store it, but to, you know, turn it into something else. Because when you're in the, you know, in your middle of the, you know, like right now, we don't really need to worry about make stuff right now to store it for the bitter spring. You know, we're making it because we want to eat it now and because we like pickles. And that's also why we don't, only during the, for the winter market, we do jars. But the rest of the time we sell stuff, you know, bulk, weigh it as people ask for it. And same thing when we do mail order, we do it in real lightweight, sealable bags, which are a lot easier to ship. You know, you can put a fresher product out there faster than you can with a jar. And it also, having it in a bag is a little bit more conducive to eating it.
David has set out a tray here of about 10 different products we've tried too. What else is here?
We do about 8 different kinds of peppers. We have one here called a padrone, which is a fairly mild pepper, which we brined in vinegar and mint. And it's real popular, like tapas bars, and it's got a nice minty flavor. And they're not hot at all.
Looks like a hot pepper, but it's not hot.
It's not, and it hits you when you first bite into it. It has that, you think it's going to be hot, but it's not. So then we have a lot of different peppers. We have a criollo pepper. We have cayenne pepper. We have this little one that's, when it's fresh, they're purple and bright orange, called an Aurora.
These hot ones, do they lose their heat in pickling just automatically, or is it something you do by choice, or do they not lose their heat?
They don't really lose. Some of them will lose their heat. Every once in a while we'll bite into one, like the Aurora, and go, you know, that was like devastating when it was fresh, and it's not as devastating when it's pickled. When we do the peppers, when we are in the middle of pepper season, we're getting in, you know, 200-300 pounds of peppers and cleaning them and sorting them and all that. And every once in a while we're like, was that box of criollos or was that the cayennes? And it's like, I don't know, let's taste one. So, you know, you taste about, you know, you have about 15 tastes of peppers while you're making pepper pickles, and you can't taste anything for a while. We do a lot of different peppers. And then this here is cactus or nopales. You know, if you ever slice into a cactus and it's got that kind of, like, you know, you can almost see the cells, and it's got that kind of gooey aloe stuff in it, and it's really active, and it really brined extremely well, and it didn't end up being slimy. So we got the peppers, we got the green bean. Oh, we have our garlic green beans, which are extremely popular. Oregon does a really, you know, really, really nice bean crop, and these brine extremely well. You know, the cell structure allows it to suck up vinegar very quickly. And we also have carrots, which brine, we do a little bit longer heat process on those because they're so dense. And this is our spicy carrot. We've got a little bit of cumin, garlic, bay leaf, red peppers. Then we have our beets. This is an orange fennel beet. We just use a standard beet, and it's got orange juice as well as salt and vinegar and crushed fennel and black pepper.
Now, these are rather large chunks, and beet is a very solid vegetable. How come you don't have to cut it smaller?
Again, we do it like the carrot. It's subjected to a little bit more heat. And, you know, you try not to overcook it, but you want to get it so that the stuff gets into it. Also, butternut squash. We do a bunch of different squashes, hard squashes, which come out really, really well. This is kind of a sweet brine, again, like the bread and butter pickles.
I see two pickles here.
Cucumber,
I have to say that, yeah. And cucumbers are the most common, most widely known pickled food. Sweet, sour. What can you do with cucumbers? What do people do and what do you do?
We do a number of things with them. We try to get a kind of medium-sized cucumber. We don't go for the really, really big ones just because they get kind of leggy. The older it is, the less lively I feel it is. They can get kind of floppy. So we go for kind of like a medium to small-sized cucumber.
And you mentioned that you use organic, not all the time, but when you can get it, basically.
Being at the farmer's market, we have a lot of stuff immediately available. Not all of the farmers at the market are organic. Some of them are transitional. Some of them are, you know, they're all different versions of it. When we don't get organic, we're trying to focus more on local, on proximity. You know, there's this, you know, what do we want to get something that takes 2 days to get here that's organic from Southern California? Or do we want something that's transitional, that's from the Willamette Valley, from the guy in the booth next to me? If I had to balance it, I would take the guy next to me. I mean, we obviously want to go for a really high-quality product all around. There's also stuff that we do through, you know, like things that we pickled just for necessity, like the green tomatoes. Oregon has an awesome green tomato crop. And I would say, you know, maybe the majority of the cucumbers that are grown never make it to ripeness, it seems like. So at the end of the season, we buy a lot of green tomatoes. I always had these when I was a kid growing up in the East Coast. And when I moved out here and saw that, how much green tomatoes there were, I was just really excited about it. And they pickle just like a cucumber. And they hold really well. And these we did with caraway and garlic. And we just, you know, just the whole tomato goes right in the brine. We don't cut it or anything. And it sits in the brine for... Some of these we're curing for like 3 months.
How can our listeners eat Picklopolis pickles?
Well, we sell them, again, we're at the farmer's market. And, of course, at our restaurant at Three Square Grill in Hillsdale. We sell it by the pound, and you can get it anytime here. And then also at our website, which is picklopolis.com, we do mail order, and we have a list of all the stuff that's available. And we ship it out the next day.
Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome.
And that was Bruce interviewing David Barber at his restaurant. And I went with him to record that interview. David Barber enjoys his pickles so much that we ate pickles for the entire interview. It was lots of fun. Roberta?
Well, not only did David say that those foods that were fresh and from the market were excellent for you, but they're also good eating for all of us. And growers are bringing their fresh food to farmers markets opening around the state. Now, the Portland Farmers Market has four locations. Their Saturday market runs from 8:30 to 2 and is located between Harris and Montgomery in downtown Park Blocks. They opened the 1st of April. And that one is scheduled to run clear through December this year. Their Wednesday market on Southwest Salmon and Main is also in the Park Blocks, and it'll run from May through October. And there are two Thursday locations, both starting June 1st. The downtown location is again this year at the Echo Trust and the east side location on Southeast Salmon and 20th. You can get an attractive brochure mailed to you that gives additional background information. Call 503-241-0032 or find them on the web at portlandfarmersmarket.org. They're preparing a statewide brochure, which should be available in a couple of weeks. We'll leave the phone numbers and the website addresses at the desk, and you can call and get them. Now, in the metro area, there are year-round weekly markets at People's Co-op. Also, Alberta Farmers Co-op store has a farmers market. Hollywood has a farmers market. The Interstate District has a farmers market. Hillsdale and Moreland both have them. At WWW Oregon Farmers Markets, there's a directory of all of these markets plus others around the state. The website address has the times of the markets, who's coordinating them with their phone numbers, so you can call and find out how many booths different growers have. Are there lots of vendors coming? Are there special events at the markets, demonstrations by cooks and those kinds of things? And most markets are accepting Oregon Trail food stamps. So we urge you to support your local growers and shop at the farmers markets. Another way that you can get food that's fresh from the grower is to join a CSA. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and in the Portland area, we have a CSA coalition. They create a list of growers in this area. The website to find them is pacsac.org. Again, we'll have that information at the desk. Some of the ones in this area are as far away as Albany, so you'll want to call to find out, do you deliver? And how big is the box and how much is the share? Some of the growers, you can buy a half a share rather than a whole share. Some of them have them available for you once a week. Some have them twice a week. All these things that you need to know before you become associated with a particular CSA. Or you can find out by giving them a call. What the other thing that you want to know is this a grower that's going to allow you to come to the farm and actually participate yourself in the growing, or are they buy-it-only kind of CSA? It's a wonderful experience for people in town to be able to go to their farm and find out what all is involved in raising the food that they're going to eat. So we encourage you to eat that fresh food directly from the grower, however you get it. And the attraction of these arrangements is that you get to deal directly with the person that is working the fields and getting the food for you.
Thank you, Gabota. Let's see. You're listening to the Food Show on KABU. Next up is another in the seafood series with biologist Alice Cass-Corby. Today, we're going to hear about octopus and squid. I understand that the octopus and squid are quite aggressive predators. Can you tell us about them?
Well, they are predators. Both octopus and squid are animals that hunt actively for other animals. Octopus hunt on the ground or the ocean floor, creeping around and swimming a little bit, whereas squid swim all the time. They're up in the water column, jetting around like little ramjets, basically. Very, very fast swimmers. Octopus and squid, which are related animals, as you probably realize from the tentacles, both of them are very brainy for mollusks.
What do you mean, very brainy?
For an animal that's in the same family as the clam and the oyster and the snail, an octopus is a very smart creature. Octopuses in labs have learned to discern textures on glass bottles and open them with their little arms to get a food reward that's hidden inside. They can see color. They communicate with each other by flushing color across their skins in rapid flashes. They are sight hunters. Both octopus and squid can see very well.
I don't think I've seen octopus on the market, although we do see squid quite frequently in restaurants. What's with the market and octopus? Is there a season?
There's a bit of a season, but the main thing is ethnicity. You will find octopus in Asian markets more than in Western markets. Octopus is traditional in Greek food, too. So if you go to a Greek restaurant or an Asian restaurant, you might find octopus dishes. You'll definitely find octopus as sushi. I've seen boiled prepared octopus tentacles for sushi on sale at like Uwajimaya or even sometimes at Whole Foods, that kind of place. It's there in small quantities. Squid is more popular and getting more popular. When I was a kid, it was something kind of strange to see fried calamari, but it's gotten more and more popular, and rightly so, back to the Mediterranean roots of some of our ancestry in eating good calamari. The West Coast has a fine squid fishery. They're called Lolago opalescens. That's their scientific name. They're the small squid that you probably see in the market. They're about 6 to 8 inches long, including the tentacles. Those little squid are very, very plentiful. They are really cheap. They tend to go for between 99 cents and about $2 a pound, depending on where and when. And they're caught right here along the West Coast between, you know, California and British Columbia. That is a great sustainable fishery. If you want to eat low on the food chain and support a local fishery, go for some of those small local squid.
And is there a season?
They are usually fished in the summer and early fall, but you can find them frozen at almost any time. The little West Coast squid freeze very well.
If I go down the new seasons to the fish counter, would I find octopus?
Chances are no, but you'd probably find squid. I have to say, when we're talking about sustainable fisheries, the research that I've participated in shows that really octopus is probably something to avoid because they don't breed very quickly. Most of the fisheries are unregulated. A lot of octopus species that were common in the Mediterranean at one point have been fished out. The octopus that are getting on the market come mostly from Asia, some from here on the West Coast that get shipped to Asia. Some of those return to us as a frozen product via Asian markets.
There's a lot of transportation costs.
Definitely a lot of transportation costs. And just ecologically, octopus are really hard to study. They're very cryptic, as we say. They are masters of camouflage and disguise. They are very, very good at hiding. They can change their color to match what they're sitting on. Scientists who've tried to do population counts on octopus often have a huge time just finding them. If you don't even know how many octopus are out there, you can't design a fishery that is sustainable. The other thing we know is that they don't breed especially fast. Octopus, there's just too many scientific unknowns about the animals to say, are we exploiting them at a level that they can keep up with, or are we causing them to decline? We've certainly seen octopus populations drop in the Mediterranean, where they've been a popular food item for thousands of years. With modern fishing and the modern demand, there are just probably too many people trying to eat them. So I'd say give octopus a rest. That won't be hard for most people, but if you're eating sushi and you feel like eating a cephalopod, try the squid. Most squid are much more plentiful. The little Lolago squid that are from here on the West Coast couldn't be much greener. So have at it. They're wonderful in all kinds of recipes. Some of the other squid you might see are larger. If you find a squid whose body is over about 8 inches long or sometimes almost up to 2 feet, that's an Asian squid or an Australian squid.
Are they more prolific than the octopus?
Yeah, the squid tend to be more prolific. They tend to breed sooner in life. Octopus can take many years to mature, 6 to 8 years for some of the bigger kinds of octopus. And most of these animals only breed once. They're kind of like salmon in that they breed and then they die. Mother octopus lay a bunch of eggs in strings and often tend those eggs in a nest, keeping the eggs clean and sweeping water toward them to keep them oxygenated. The mother octopus doesn't eat during that period and tends to die soon after her babies hatch out. Octopus are not the kind of animal that can take an awful lot of fishing. Squid, on the other hand, although most of them breed only once, too, they lay a lot more eggs at once. The little Lolago squid from here on the Pacific coast have a life cycle that's only a year or 18 months long. They breed very prolifically. Much like sardines, they're very low on the food chain and tend to be a very plentiful little animal.
How do we fish for octopus and squid?
Octopus are taken by a variety of methods. There's some trapping that's done. They get caught in crab traps. They go for the same kind of bait as crabs. The spot prawn fishery of Monterey, California actually started as an octopus fishery. It was Italian immigrants looking for the octopus that they loved to eat and catching them in these little traps, which had shrimp as bycatch, the spot prawns. Gradually over the decades, that's shifted such that the prawns are the valuable item and the octopus are bycatch, usually let go or seldom sold. But trapping, occasionally spearing, depending on where it's happening. Octopus fisheries tend to be small, in our area at least, and not very well regulated. There's some off of British Columbia that I believe they actually use divers to catch some of the big octopus.
How big is a big octopus?
Well, there's one species called the giant Pacific octopus that, with head and body together, can be 6 to 8 feet long. And that's a head about the size of a sofa pillow, a soft, squishy body. And then these long tentacles that are about 5 feet long in a big adult.
We might not want to tangle with that in the ocean, would we?
You'd think. They're predators, but they tend to be very much afraid of people. If you go bug them and stick your hands right up against them, they might bite you. They have a hard, horny little beak at the center of their tentacles, which is their mouth. And many of them have a mildly poisonous bite. But octopus tend to be very shy and very cryptic. They tend to hide instead of fighting and to get away if they possibly can.
Have you ever seen one out in the ocean?
They're wonderful when you see them. They're so boneless and graceful. They don't have bones. They're mollusks. One of their talents is slipping into and out of very, very tiny cracks and crevices. They can work an arm into a crack in a coral reef or something to grab a fish or another item of prey that's hiding from them. And if they're kept in captivity, they're very, very good at slipping out of aquariums, even through tiny, you know, half-inch cracks that are at the top of the aquarium, between the aquarium and its lid.
They sound like very fascinating critters.
Octopus are really pretty neat animals. Aside from not breeding quickly, they're also very interesting in their own right and maybe deserve to be let alone more than eaten. You know, that's a personal opinion.
An educated personal opinion.
I guess. Every species has its interesting points. You might have heard about giant squid. There are squid of all sizes, ranging from just a couple of inches long at adulthood to the giant squid species, which we know is 30 feet long, tip to tail.
Where do they live?
The giant squids live in the very deep Pacific Ocean off of any land masses. The ones that have been seen recently have been trawled up in fishing trawl nets off of Australia. Just last year, I believe it was, a Japanese group sent some bait way, way down with a camera to try to film a giant squid in the wild and succeeded for the first time. What they eat down there is probably fish. We know that they're eaten by sperm whales. There are these stories of giant squid carcasses being found in sperm whale stomachs during the days of commercial whaling, especially. The squid that live way down, including the giant squid, have a lot of ammonia in their tissue. It's a natural waste product. They've evolved to let it build up in the tissue to keep them buoyant. That makes them kind of unpalatable, tastes like ammonia. The giant squid are probably safe from fishing exploitation because they just have too much ammonia in their flesh. How squid are caught? Here on the West Coast, they are usually caught by mini purse seine net technique. One thing that has in common with all of the squid fisheries across the Pacific is that many types of squid are attracted by light. And they will come out at night, be swimming around, and sometimes out for breeding at night. A bright, bright electric light shown into the water will attract them. For decades, fishermen have used lamps as the bait when they're catching squid. Here on the Pacific coast, if you're ever near the ocean late at night and you see a bright, bright light on a small boat close to shore, it's probably a squid fishing boat. The purse seining, in this case, is a very bycatch-free method. Most other animals aren't attracted to the light like that. The squid fisheries around here are pretty clean.
Sounds like we should be eating squid. How do we prepare it?
Oh, there's so many different ways. One of the really great things about both octopus and squid, if you're going to eat them, and I'll just say squid, is you can eat almost the whole animal. I mean, there aren't any bones. Almost the entire thing is edible. I love to deep fry them, classic calamari style. You remove the innards and then the little tentacles and the hollow body are both completely edible. Then there's also, you can flash fry them, use them in stir fry. You can put them in salads. You can flash fry them and then pickle them lightly with vinegar and then chop them up as part of a Mediterranean salad with maybe some Parmesan cheese and olives and lettuce. Those are some ideas.
Sounds really good. There's quite a few fish in the sea off the coast of Oregon that are pretty green. The sardines, farmed oysters.
Yeah, good and sustainable. I'd add to that list the Dungeness crab. Our local albacore tuna are well-managed and very prolific. Some of the well-managed salmon fisheries, although salmon is a separate topic, among the common seafoods that we harvest from right here, the squid, the Dungeness crab, the sardines, mackerel, if you can find it, the albacore tuna, all of those are excellent green ecological choices for good seafood right from our local ocean. If there's a seafood you want to try and you don't see it at a market, ask if they could order it in. It would help to increase the demand for the green seafoods that people ask for.
Thank you, Alice.
Thank you so much, Kate.
I'm Martha Wainwright.
Last week, I had a chance to interview Charlie Corns of Northwest Veg about vegetarianism in Portland. I think with all the activity surrounding vegetarianism and health these days, people like Charlie are the shining star of reaching out and getting people involved in their community. Here's my interview with Charlie. And as we get that ready, here we go.
Charlie Corns serve as the president of a local nonprofit called Northwest Veg, VEG. That is an acronym, stands for Vegetarian Education and Empowerment Group.
What are you out there on the streets doing with Northwest Veg, and who's involved?
Right, well, we have 230 members who pay annual dues to be part of the group. Of course, the work is really being done by a handful of core volunteers, let's say a couple dozen who we can really count on. And we have monthly potlucks, vegetarian, mostly vegan.
So are the potlucks just attended by members, and are they held here in town? Or
the potlucks are held every month. We've been alternating east and west side of town. They're open to anybody. We put out our announcements in various newspapers. They tend to be, let's say, 60% members, and the rest of the people who show up are guests or first-time potluck attendees. And it's great. We got an incredible variety of vegetarian foods.
How many people come out to the potlucks?
We get anywhere from 30 to 70 people at our potlucks.
That's astonishing. And are they all vegetarians, or are they mostly people interested in learning more about vegetarianism? Who's coming?
Right. We certainly don't limit these potlucks to vegetarians. That's the whole idea of Northwest Veg, is to welcome people to the possibilities within the realm of vegetarian cuisine. And you know, if this is the only vegetarian meal someone eats all month, that's cool. We just want to make them feel at home and not judged, because I think quite a few of us have seen other elements in the vegetarian movement that are more judgmental of people's food choices, and we try hard to be conscious of that and to provide more of a welcoming environment at our potlucks. And we also have dine-outs where we go to a different restaurant every month. We just had one a few days ago at a place over on Belmont called It's a Beautiful Pizza.
And what's the criteria of how do you choose a restaurant to go and meet at?
Well, they need to be vegan friendly, if not completely vegetarian.
What's vegan?
Vegan would refer to food choices that involve no meat, no eggs, no dairy, actually no animal ingredients, animal-derived ingredients.
And so, Charlie, you seem to be someone that has your finger on the business community in Portland, on the pulse of what's going on in and around Portland and Vancouver, specifically surrounding vegetarians. And so do you find that there's a lot of vegetables around here, or how did Portland turn out to be number one on PETA's best vegetarian cities list?
That's right, Jake. This spring, PETA did announce that Portland had surpassed Seattle and San Francisco as the most veg-friendly large city in the United States, and we're excited about that, and we like to think that we might have contributed to that choice. I personally manage a website, nwveg.org, that lists 60 or 70 restaurants in the Portland area, most of which are veg-friendly, but about 20 of which are actually vegetarian. And we do have three completely vegan restaurants in Portland.
What is the bigger implication of people leaving the meat out?
Right. Well, you know, in Portland, we've got a vegetarian food co-op. In addition to all those restaurants, we've got great farmers markets. Bottom line is it's very easy to be vegetarian. And then you get to the issue of why would anybody want to be vegetarian? And I think there's different motivations from people depending on their background. Some people choose a vegetarian diet strictly for the sake of the animals because for one reason or another, they've come to learn about the conditions of today's factory farms. This country alone, approximately 10 billion animals are killed every year for food. About 9 billion or more of which are chickens. And worldwide, you know, that number is two or three times that amount. So it is a concern for people who've come to sense the suffering of the innocent animals that are dying, you know, every minute so that people can have bacon and hamburgers and chicken sandwiches and so forth. Another concern some people may have is for the environment. These factory farms create an atrocious amount of animal waste, approximately 2.7 trillion pounds of it each year, according to the Sierra Club.
That's a lot of waste.
No kidding.
And what do they do with all that waste?
Well, they try hard to manage it, but they're not always successful, and there have been many spills over the years, which is really sad because when the waste gets out into the environment, there'll be harm done to other species as well as the human effects that we can smell and experience in the water and air. In 1995, for example, an 8-acre hog waste lagoon in North Carolina burst, spilling 25 million gallons of animal waste into a river, the New River. The spill killed as many as 10 million fish and closed almost 400,000 acres of coastal wetlands. So there are many examples of spills like that where these wastes have gotten out into the environment.
So what can you tell our listeners that might not be interested in vegetarianism for all the stinkiness of it? How can we get involved, and what's going on with your group locally?
Well, that is another motivation for a lot of people who begin to reduce the amount of meat or cut it out altogether in their diets, which is health. There have been books written on the subject of a better diet, and you might have heard of Dean Ornish, his studies involving heart disease. There's a new book out, fairly new, by T. Colin Campbell, Ph.D., called The China Study. If somebody looks at that book, there are documented case studies from a long-term China study involving health, heart disease, diabetes, nutrition, cancer. It was actually the largest epidemiological study ever conducted, known as the China Project. So there are quite a few reasons to go veg for the sake of one's health. And locally, Northwest Veg is there every month with its potlucks, dine-outs. We do have special events. We bring speakers to town. Just last month, we had over 1,000 people come to our Veg Fest downtown. People paid $5 to get in, and they could see speakers like a nationally known nutritionist named George Eisman address issues around nutrition and dairy consumption linked to breast cancer, for example. They could see demonstrations from great chefs. The head chef over at Blossoming Lotus Restaurant gave a demonstration. And we had a demo by someone who specializes in baking and chocolate, Julie Hassan. So it was an incredible event. You know, based on our exit survey, approximately a third were not vegetarian. And we'd like to think that they're beginning to eat differently as they proceed, you know, with their food choices.
That sounds exciting. How do people incorporate vegetarian food into their diets at home cooking? Where can people go out and find vegetarian food to buy, to bring home and cook?
At Northwest Veg, we encourage people to patronize the locally owned businesses. For example, I'm a member of People's Co-op over on Southeast 21st Avenue near Powell. And, you know, as a member, I feel like I'm supporting a community that values organic farming, sustainable, local. You know, the more local our food is, the less it has to travel. And anytime there's travel, transportation associated with food, then there's petroleum energy use that's being burned up. And, you know, that's, we can consciously reduce that in our food choices. We can support the local co-ops. We can go to the farmer's market. We could actually establish a relationship with a farm through something called CSA, Community Supported Agriculture. And that involves a subscription to a service that will bring you a bin full of fresh produce, seasonal, every week. And, you know, if somebody's just starting to get into this, you know, I definitely recommend that they reach out to connect with other people for that kind of support and friendship.
When you cook, is it primarily tofu that you're eating, or what do you like to eat yourself?
Oh, you know, I do eat tofu, but I also eat tempeh, which is a soy-based product as well. It's a fermented, aged soy product. I eat other forms of beans, legumes. There's a pretty large family out there. You know, you've got garbanzo beans and kidney beans. Of course, I eat a lot of salads. And as a vegan, I need to be concerned about some aspects of nutrition that take extra effort, such as calcium and B12 and the omega-3 fatty acids. And you know, certain things that I like to eat to obtain those nutrients. For example, flaxseed is just a superb source of the omega-3s that I'm not getting because I don't eat fish. But I'm not getting the fat that I would be getting if I ate the fish. And I'm not causing the death of, you know, another being that swims in the earth. So that's important to me. Also, at our potlucks, we always have a presentation of some kind after the meal. Like, for example, this potluck that's coming up, we're having a speaker address the eco-footprint of each of us in the context of our food choices. And I've heard it said time and time again that the best things we can do for the environment are to stop driving cars and stop eating meat. So in this case, we're going to be addressing the second solution to some of our environmental problems, which is to eat less or no meat.
And how does eating less meat affect the environment?
As I mentioned earlier, there's a great deal of pollution that is associated with today's factory farming that wasn't around a couple hundred years ago. In addition to that, cattle grazing in order to meet the demands for hamburgers and steaks all over the planet. There's an incredible amount. Roughly a quarter of the entire surface of the earth is used for cattle grazing. So if we can eat less meat, we're reducing the demand on that industry. And in the process of clearing forests for cattle grazing, many species are affected and habitat is lost, especially in the Central American rainforests.
Northwest Veg is a great local group that is out there encouraging people to think about what they're eating and how their food affects the environment and the lives of those around them. This is Jake Wallner for the KBOO Food Collective interviewing Charlie Corns of Northwest Veg. Thanks a lot for coming in today, Charlie.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Jake, for that interview.
Well, we want to remind everyone that Earth Day is coming up Saturday, April 22nd, and we're going to have a celebration right here in Portland. It is at the beautiful Selwood Park, free and open to the public. They're going to have entertainment, games. This is all volunteer run, free seed and plant exchanges. So those of you that have time to go any time during the day from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., want to know details about it, it's at cityrepair.org.
The price of oil is up, way up, and this affects the food that you acquire and eat. Here is some information about just how it affects the cost of food. 28% of energy used in agriculture goes to fertilizer manufacturing, 7% goes to irrigation, and 34% is consumed as diesel, oil, and gasoline by farm vehicles used to plant, till, and harvest crops. The rest goes to pesticide production, grain drying, and facility operations. New grain demand has been met in recent years primarily by raising land productivity through higher-yielding crop varieties in conjunction with more oil-intensive mechanization, irrigation, and fertilizer use rather than by expanding cropland. Crop production now relies on fertilizers to replace soil nutrients and therefore on the oil needed to mine, manufacture, and transport those fertilizers. Fertilizer use has, however, leveled off in the United States since 1984, and it has leveled off in India as of 1998. The use of mechanical pumps to irrigate crops has increased farm energy use, but as water tables drop, ever more powerful pumps must be used. Food today travels farther than ever. As food travels farther, energy use soars. Trucking accounts for the majority of food transport, though it is nearly 10 times more energy intensive than moving goods by rail or barge. Refrigerated jumbo jets, 60 times more energy intensive than sea transport, constitute a small but growing sector of food transport. Processed foods now make up 3/4 of the total world food sales. This requires energy for processing and packaging, plus energy for refrigeration during transport, at the store, and in homes. Processing any can of fruits or vegetables is a high energy use, especially for mining and manufacturing the steel for cans. Processing breakfast cereals requires easily 5 times as much energy as is contained in the cereal itself. So conclusions to be drawn are that buying fewer processed, heavily packaged, and frozen foods can cut energy use and marketing costs. Eating lower on the food chain can reduce pressure on land, water, and energy supplies. Decoupling the food system from the oil industry is key to improving food security. What I've just read to you was written by Danielle Murray from the Earth Policy Institute, and it was in an article from the Permaculture Activist, a magazine about permaculture farming and gardening.
And I want to remind people what a special time of year this is. Recently, the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission hosted the annual First Salmon Feast, which included rituals, prayers, ceremonies, honoring the return of the life-giving fish and paying necessary homage to allow the life cycle to begin anew, which is traditional before people start fishing, hunting, root digging, and the gathering season. The ceremonial feast consisted of salmon, venison, roots, and finally berries. And also for the Jews, this is a special time of year for Passover, which consists of a Seder, also a ritual feast, which is one of the most significant holidays, which began Wednesday at sundown. And the food must be fresh, prepared from scratch, kosher, and it's an 8-day holiday containing no leaven products. The feast, it's usually known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and honors the slaves who did not have time for bread to rise, according to the Book of Exodus. Locally, there's a lot of great things going on with cheese, and Cheese 101 is happening at Curds and Whey at 7 p.m., April 22nd, and that's pdxcheese.com for more information. And we'll have all this up at the front desk, so call down to KBOO to find out what's going on locally with cheese. Also, the American Cheese Society's annual conference and competition is coming up in early July, 20th through the 22nd at the Hilton, Portland. And there's a number of wonderful things going on at cheesesociety.org. There's more information. So call down to KBOO and check out what's going on locally with the cheese scene. My last bit of food news is that Whole Foods is opening their second store on Sandy and 41st.
Well, that's about all for the food show this month. Tune in next month on the third Monday at 10 a.m.
Yeah, we're going to have Eric Schlosser here in the studio. The author of Fast Food Nation has a new book out, a completely rewritten version of Fast Food Nation for young people. It's called Chew On This, and that'll be on the third Monday in May, the 15th, at 10 a.m. on the food show.
And if you've missed any of the websites or phone numbers that we've given out today, you can get them at the front desk after the show is over. That would be by calling KBOO at 231-8032. And I'd like to just thank our guests, David Barber, Charlie Corns, and Alice Cass Corby, and also I'd like to thank our fabulous engineer, Tammy Dean. This has been the Food Show at KBOO.
Need some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same old boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right.
This coming Tuesday, April 18th at 7:30 a.m., all three candidates for Multnomah County Chair will square off on the issues with Joe Uris, Abe Proctor, and you, the call-in audience. A no-holds-barred confrontation this coming Tuesday, April 18th at 7:30 a.m., the Multnomah County Chair Race. Don't miss it.
Coming up on KBOO tomorrow. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming right up, it's Democracy Now!